Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi, I'm Zivi Owens, and I am the host of this podcast, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. I am also a newly minted USA Today bestselling author of the novel Blank. I've created a whole community of book lovers around this podcast, a publishing company, reading retreats, a bookstore, and more. Learn more at zivimedia.com or follow me on social at Zivi Owens or join the community at Zivi Readers. Tommy Tomlinson is the author of Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show, and also the beautiful memoir, The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. Tommy and I did this podcast live at the Asheville Retreat, which was so much fun. He was a participant for the whole retreat, really got to know him. He's fabulous, and these books are really first rate. Here's his bio. Tommy is the host of the podcast Southbound at WFAE, Charlotte's NPR station, and he also does weekly commentaries for the station. He has a Substack newsletter called The Writing Shed and has written for publications including Esquire, ESPN the Magazine, Sports Illustrated, Forbes, Garden and Gun, and many others. He spent 23 years as a reporter and local columnist for the Charlotte Observer. He's a graduate of the University of Georgia and was a 2008-9 Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Tommy and his wife, Alex Felsing, live in Charlotte. Welcome, Tommy. Thank you so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure, too. So we have two books to talk about, and we are doing this as a live event in the Asheville Retreat Ballroom here. And my dog, Naya, is literally next to your foot, so I could not have arranged this any better.
It's the perfect setting.
It's the perfect setting. Okay, two books to discuss. Your book that is just coming out now is called Dogland. Can you tell everybody what it's about?
Sure. It's about a lot of things. It's kind of about the Westminster Dog Show. That's what the subtitle is. Glory, Passion, and a Lot of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. But the Westminster is just sort of a prism to talk about the connection that people and dogs have, which has developed over 30,000 years. I think there's a case to be made that the dog is mankind's greatest invention because we created them. From gray wolves, and every dog that exists in the world today is descended from the same gray wolf. And we have developed them over thousands of years to do all sorts of things for us, but it turns out that they've developed us too. I think we can say that they domesticated us as much as we domesticated them. And that book is about that connection.
So you talk in the book about how you can go to all these dog shows. Each one's a little different. Nobody's barking. And are the dogs even happy? What could they possibly be experiencing? What is your view on this now that you've been on the road and checked it all out?
Well, I think this is kind of what the book comes around to, is that the idea of what makes us happy. So the book kind of originated with this idea as I was watching a dog show one night and just sort of thought, are those dogs happy or not? Because they live such a different life than regular dogs. And after experiencing that for about 3 years, going to probably 100 dog shows and just being really immersed in that world, I think they are happy, but I think it depends on how you see happiness. And I don't want to kind of spoil the ending of the book, but I sort of come around to a philosophy of happiness that I think applies not just to dogs, but to everybody. And I think they have figured out how to get us to make them happy in the same way that they make us happy.
Okay, you can't keep the secret of happiness a secret.
Oh, yeah, I can, sure. I can keep the secret of happiness a secret until the book's been out a couple weeks. I mean, I think basically it gets down to the way I describe it as treats and time. So just think about the people in your life that make you most happy. What do? They provide you with treats. I mean, they like shower you with gifts, but they're fun to be around. They give you things through their personality or their heart or whatever it is that makes you want to be around them more. And they spend time with you. They spend enough time that they know you, they care about you, you come to care about them. This is what dogs have figured out. If you give a dog enough treats, if you spend enough time with them, they'll love you forever. And they figured that out about us too. And so I think that's, for whatever the secret of happiness is in regards to this book. Anyway, I think that's it.
When you set out to uncover the secrets of this whole world, best in show style, if you will, what is something that you were not expecting that you saw or heard on the road?
Well, the first thing I wasn't expecting at the beginning of the book, I talk about this, is the lack of things. Like when I first got to the Westminster Dog Show, and no dogs were barking. It's just such a weird experience to be around 2,000 dogs that aren't making any noise. And so that thought of that, they're so well trained that they don't bark even when they're around. You know, the old dog I had, if he was around one other dog, he would go crazy, right? But beyond that, I think the day-to-day thing that really struck me was how incredibly detailed the grooming of each dog is. So I follow this one dog through the whole narrative, a Samoyed named Striker, who's a longtime champion show dog. It takes about 6 hours to get Striker ready for the show every day. Just combing, bathing. There are like six different types of combs. There are all these different, you know, there's like three different blow dryers. It's like when you see these time-lapse photos of like a Hollywood actors in a some big budget movie with lots of special effects, and you see him like put on makeup for 6 hours, that's what this is like. And I was not expecting that level of detail to make them look as perfect as possible.
He's like a talk show host. I referenced this last night, but you wrote so beautifully about, and I'm just going to find this passage, you wrote so beautifully about your own dog, Fred, and how much joy he brought you. So let me just, can I read a paragraph? Is that okay? Okay. This is just one paragraph to talk about Fred. Fred was an orphan, and we tried to imagine what the first few weeks of his life were like before he found us. He startled easily. For a while, he would camp out under our coffee table, but anytime there was a sudden movement, he'd leap up and bonk his head on the underside. We suspected he got a couple of dog concussions. But he was also scared of odd, specific things. He cowered from white vans. He was terrified of children. Not just children, but stuff that was child-adjacent. One morning, when we were out on a walk, he circled way out into the street to avoid a big wheel some kid had left on the sidewalk. We pieced together a dark story in our heads about mean children and white vans. We wished he could tell us what had happened to him so we could keep him safe.
Yeah, so there's a kind of an interlude in this book where, in the midst of all the dog show stuff, I talk about the dog my wife and I had for 14 and a half years, who showed up in our front yard one day in the ditch as a puppy, a stray puppy that we believe somebody let go. And we had him his entire life. And I think that all the stages of bonding with a dog and that connection and all that thing that I try to get to in the bigger picture of the book, trying to tell in sort of a miniature version when it comes to Fred. You know, the thing about dogs, and this, you know, there are funny parts of the book too, so I want to make sure that it's clear. But the thing about the dog or any pet is it sort of inverts the natural order, right? As those of you who are parents, you expect to die before your children do. But when you have a pet, when you, as soon as you take that pet on, you probably know that it's going to die before you do. And so you have to experience that sort of reversed wave of grief in a way that you don't usually have to with your human children. You know, there's a lot of research involved and anecdotal evidence about how sometimes people grieve harder for a pet than they do for the other humans in their lives. There are a lot of reasons for that. I think the main one being that it's just a less complicated relationship. Mm. But also, it does, in that order is reversed, and it's something that our nature does not expect to happen until it does.
Well, this book is truly beautiful, and anyone who's ever had a dog will not only be interested, but it will bring tears to their eyes and make them laugh, which is just great. And I know Naya really appreciates us discussing it today.
She seems to be handling it well. There's no criticism so far.
She literally has her paw wrapped around Tommy's heel at the moment, as we're, like, literally. But today is a twofer, because Tommy also wrote The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. This book is so good, and I am so sad I have not finished it in time for this interview, because I only got it when we got down here, and it's so good. I've already started recommending it, and it's amazing. And this I definitely want to read. Can I read the beginning of this, just like the first page? Okay. I'm going to just jump to New Year's Eve 2014. Okay. New Year's Eve 2014. I weigh 460 pounds. Those are the hardest words I've ever had to write. Nobody knows that number. Not my wife, not my doctor, not my closest friends. It feels like confessing a crime. The average American male weighs 195 pounds. I'm two of those guys with a 10-year-old left over. I'm the biggest human being most people who know me have ever met or ever will. The government definition of obesity is a body mass index of 30 or more. My BMI is 60.7. My shirts are size XXXXXXL, which the big and tall stores shorten to 6X. I'm 6'1" or 73 inches tall. My waist is 60 inches around. I'm nearly a sphere. Those are the numbers. This is how it feels. I'm just going to read one more paragraph. I'm on the subway in New York City, standing in the aisle, clinging to the pole. I live in Charlotte and don't visit New York much, so I don't have a feel for how subway cars move. I'm praying this one doesn't lurch around a corner or slam to a stop, because I'm terrified of falling. Part of it is embarrassment. When a fat guy falls, it's hard to get up. But what really scares me is the chance I might land on somebody. I glance at the people wedged around me. None of them could take my weight. It would be an avalanche. Some of them stare at me, and I figure they're thinking the same thing. There's an old woman sitting 3 feet away. One slip, and I'd crush her. I grip the pole harder. My palms start to sweat, and all of a sudden, I flash back to elementary school in Georgia, standing in the aisle of the bus. The driver hollers at me to find a seat. He can't take us home until everybody sits down. I'm the only one standing. Every time I spot an open space, somebody slides to the edge of the seat and covers it up. Nobody wants the fat boy mashed in next to them. I freeze, helpless. The driver glares at me in the rearview mirror. An older kid sitting in front of me, a redhead, freckles, I'll never forget his face, has a cast on his right arm. He reaches back and starts clubbing me with it, below the waist, out of the driver's line of sight. He catches me in the groin and it hurts, but not as much as the shame when the other kids laugh and the bus driver gets up and storms toward me. And the train stops and jolts me back into now. So incredibly powerful.
Well, thank you. So when there's a fairly long backstory to this book. I was afraid to write it for years and years. This scene I have in New York is a scene where I'm actually sitting down with my agent, telling them kind of the story, or similar stories. He's like, well, dude, that's the book you want to write. And then I didn't write it for like 3 more years after that. But when I did decide to write it, I thought, I've written a lot of profiles of other people. Longtime journalist, wrote big profiles for like Esquire, ESPN, those sorts of places. And I decided when I was going to write it that if I was going to do it, I was going to hold myself to the same account that I would hold somebody else, which is I want to tell the truth the best I can and not leave anything out that needs to be in there. And so once I set out to do it, I tried to treat myself like somebody I was doing a story on, because that's kind of what was happening. And of course, I knew a lot more about myself than I would about anybody else ever covering. And so I didn't write a lot in there. I tried not to write sort of lurid details just to have them in there. I wanted everything to have a meaning to it and, you know, to be part of the larger story. So there are stories that I left out of there. But that was sort of the litmus test for me as I was going through. Like, does this story mean something to the story I'm trying to tell in this book? And if it does, I'm going to leave it in, whether it makes me look good or not.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Sometimes we all have stuff we need to get off our chests. Even if we don't think it's interfering with our daily life, there are some things you just haven't processed, be it grief or trauma, eating disorders, anything. It might be time to work on those things, and I have a solution for you. Therapy. Online therapy by BetterHelp. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. I took the brief questionnaire online where there were, 20 questions. It didn't take long at all, maybe 3 minutes. And then I got matched with a therapist who could help me work on whatever. I picked trauma because even though it happened in 2001, I am somehow still not over the loss of my friend on 9/11. And it is what it is. BetterHelp is going to help. And I am so excited, especially because with my special code, instead of $80 a month, it is 10% off, $72 a month, which is so much less than traditional therapy. And you'll get a perfect therapist for you. There are 35,000 therapists to choose from, so you'll find the right one. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/momsdonthavetime today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. .com/momsdonthavetime. And you talk a lot in the book about how you are essentially slowly killing yourself and how you don't know why you're doing this to yourself, but you are. How there are so many experiences in life that you wish you had lived, but you've been held back your entire life. And then you go into not only does it put you at risk, but then you talk about the loss of your sister and how tragic that was and the impact of that on you and your family and the suit you had to wear and the meals that showed up and the way you processed the grief and your mother who lived next door. Can you just talk about that a little bit? And I'm so sorry for your loss.
Ooh, that's a lot to talk about. So one of the things that sort of pushed me to do this book was that my sister died just 8 years ago now, almost 10 years ago now, on Christmas Eve. She had been overweight like me and had not really paid attention to her health very much. She had a sore on her leg that got infected and didn't get it looked at, and she died. And we went to her funeral, and I wore like the one suit that I own, basically. And as I was, we were sitting there in the family section, and I turned around and looked and saw all these people I've known all my life. And I thought, you know, if I don't get healthier, they're going to be back soon for me. Mm-hmm. And so that's what sort of pushed me to sort of not just write this book, but to go on a path to be healthier. I'm in much better shape now than I was in this telling of this book. I've lost probably a little over 100 pounds. Mm-hmm. And all the, like, health markers are much better. I can't get on the damn, like, Mounjaro or whatever, because I don't qualify. I'm like,
you have to what?
Diabetic or pre-diabetic, and I'm not. My doctor's like, you're too healthy to be on this damn obesity drug. And so that, you know, there's mixed blessings there. But that sort of pushed me in many ways, because I didn't want to be a burden. I don't want to be a burden on my family. You know, my wife has put up with me for 25 years. She's dependent on me in lots of ways, and similar to dependent on her. And I don't want her to feel like she gets left behind because I didn't take care of myself. And so all those things sort of play into, if you're obese or if you have lots of other problems, all those things sort of, I think, play in your head on a loop. And, you know, though you mentioned the funeral food, you know, when, especially in the South, I'm sure everywhere, when somebody dies, what do? They bring food. And so there's like this giant parade of, like, you know, fried stuff coming into the house at the very moment that I needed the least, right? And so so those kind of things, and just sort of my upbringing. I think one big thing that, you know, people, I try to think about, like, why did I get this way? Because nobody in my family was like this until my generation, and there's several people in my generation who are obese. My family worked very hard, blue-collar jobs, all the way up to my generation. They worked very hard so that I wouldn't have to, but we ate the same food that was fuel for them when they had to go out and, like, you know, work at the seafood plant all day. But for me, going to a desk job, it just landed on me differently. And that's been a huge reason, I think, for obesity in America, is that most of us now do sedentary jobs. And we eat the same meals that we ate when people were working in factories.
Also, I think the way they make food today is even less healthy with all the chemicals and all of that too. The way that you talk about your parents and the things that have happened to them, all they've sacrificed, their hard work. You talk about when your dad has a stroke, or your mom had a stroke. Your mom had an accident at the SeaTac factory and that damaged all the nerves in her neck and shoulders. And then your dad got sick and couldn't work. And then she had to go back to being a waitress at Denny's, carrying trays on the shoulder that was injured for 16 years.
Yeah.
Talk about that. And what does that do for you? How do you carry that and then go out into the day and write an article or profile a celebrity keeping all that?
Well, for one thing, I've never had any illusions that what I do is hard. You know, there are difficulties to it, and there are days when I feel like I'm struggling, but I've never worked a day in my life that was as hard as, like, a normal day that my mom and dad worked. And so, you know, I mentioned a little bit the other day about how they were not very educated, but very smart and big readers. In fact, that's, I think, the key to why I do what I do, is that my dad read his two cigarette texts, which were the Bible and the Bass Pro Shops catalog. And my mom devoured those little paperback romance novels. She would go to the used bookstore and literally buy, like, a box full, take them home, read them all, fill up the box, take the box back and fill up another box. You know, this would happen like six times a year at our house. And so they were voracious readers, and also big readers of the newspaper. And so that's, I think, why I became a journalist, is because I saw how much it meant to them to read and to keep up with the world. That way, even though they didn't have much of an education, they could understand the world through the newspaper. And so they were great role models to me. They, I think, struggled mightily with trying to figure out why I was fat and they weren't, because we were all eating the same thing. My mom told me much later that she and my dad used to sit in bed at night and talk about it and try to figure out what they could do. And back then, you know, there weren't many good plans. I remember going to some diet doctor when I was like 12, and as far as I could tell, he gave me like amphetamines, you know, like this, like, very bright colored pills that made me feel great and I could play basketball all day, but it didn't really affect my appetite one way or the other. And so there's just been, I think, until this like last group of weight loss drugs, it seems to be pretty amazing. As Americans, we just haven't had a really good way to tackle this problem, because it goes far beyond just willpower, right? There's so much chemistry and genetics, and not only that, the outside forces, like the way they make food now and the way that food gets advertised and all those sorts of things, they just make it very, very difficult for people who have this problem. And so I think people who don't have it often really, especially if you're a friend or a family member, just really struggle with how to like bridge that gap.
Yeah, you wrote in the book that people who don't get it, you know, feel like it's in your control. It's a laziness factor. It's something wrong with you. And then you have to carry that sort of shame around with you when you're already struggling. So how do you reconcile those two?
Well, I first of all, I don't put it all on outside forces. I've made a lot of really poor decisions in my life when it comes to food. But, you know, I think at some point, no matter what your addiction is, everybody's got something, right? Whether it's, you know, something mild or something that's like life-destroying, everybody's got some little vice that they indulge in. And I think one key to getting over the top of it is to give yourself a little grace and to understand that it's not, it's like that scene in Goodwill Hunting, it's not your fault, it's not your fault, it's not your fault. Well, I do believe that anybody who has some problem with addiction like this, part of it is their fault, it's my fraction, and you have to address that as well. But I think you also have to realize that it's part of a much bigger picture, much of which is not in your control. And to give yourself the grace to say, I'm going to tackle this not because I'm a bad person and want to become a good person, but because I'm a good person and just want to be healthy in this way. That, I think, is a switch that a lot of people find very hard to flip. Mm-hmm. But when you do, it kind of leads you out of the wilderness.
And the vulnerability in this book is just so impressive, raw, open, wonderful, but also paired with fabulous writing. And as you told us yesterday, you endeavor to write in a way that is accessible to everyone, which comes across because it just feels like the most immersive story that anyone's ever told you. How did it feel with it coming out, and how has the reception been, and has there been any blowback in any way? Like, are you glad you did it?
I'm extremely glad I did it. First of all, it was a story that I just had bottled up inside me for a long time, and just to get it out felt better. It's like a giant belt or something, you know? And there were things, as you read the excerpt, there were things I'd not talked to my wife about, not talked to anybody about. And part of the process of the book was, as I was writing these things before, it, you know, even turned it in, I had conversations with my wife and family members about all this stuff. And that was not just enlightening, but really made our relationship stronger, I think. So that was sort of the pre-publication. Once it came out, I was and have been so gratified at the reception. The only downside at all, it's very, very mild, is that I have lots of people emailing me every day, tell me about their new diet plan, you know, and it's whatever's hot at the time. Like when this came out, like fasting was a really big thing, and so I had like 100 people a day emailing me, well, if you had just done this, you know, you'd be fine. And I, you know, people aren't mostly coming at this from an angle of wanting to help, right? And so I took it that way. That was just a small portion of it. The vast majority of the feedback I've gotten was just these incredible stories, thousands and thousands. This book's been out 5 years. I still get emails about it every single day from people who saw their story and my story. And what really interested me about it, or the thing that's continually interested me, is that it's not just people who are obese. Like, I got a letter in the mail, like an actual postal letter, from a guy in Austria. I don't know how the hell he found my book in Austria, but he did. And he wrote me this 10-page letter about how much he enjoyed the book and how much he enjoyed it. And on like page 8, he said, by the way, I'm perfectly healthy. I'm not obese at all, but I suffer from depression. Mm. And depression has many of the same symptoms, many of the same root causes. It's just manifested in a different way. And I find that's true for most sort of addictive, obsessive behavior, is that there's so much in common between alcoholics and problem gamblers and obese people and all that sort of thing. So I think a lot of people have found something meaningful in my story, even if it's not their particular details. And that, to me, is just the best thing that could happen.
Well, in addition to being so open, the way you write and the way you use details, we were just talking about this in Kelly McMaster's writing workshop yesterday, even the details of how you go into a diner and have to scope out the seats and is there enough room in that banquette and how you looked at the floor plan ahead of time and how some chairs are too creaky and how navigating even just the simple act of sitting down is such a massive challenge. I mean, you put us in your head and it is so, it's just amazing. It's just, you're such a brilliant writer. And anyway, it's amazing. What advice do you have for aspiring authors?
Well, I think first of all, you have to author something, right? I know a lot of smart authors who seem to have great ideas and have like, so how much have you written? And they're like, well, I haven't really put anything on the page yet. You're not a writer until you put something on the page. And even if it's like the crappiest crap imaginable. I read an interview with the New Yorker a couple of years ago with a guy who writes for The Simpsons and wrote many of their most famous episodes. And his process is, he says, I pretend that there's this crappy little elf who comes in while I'm not looking and writes the first draft of my story. And this crappy little elf has no idea how to write. He just puts in, like, Homer says something funny and they move to the new place. It's just like the worst thing imaginable, right? And the crappy little elf tips his hat and goes to bed. So the next morning, the actual writer gets up and sees what the crappy little elf has done and says, well, this is terrible, but I can work with this, right? It's a start. And the biggest leap in any creative endeavor is from nothing to something. And so if you're still at the point where you have nothing, you got to do something. And I promise you that once you have something on the page, it gets better from there. That blank page just kills more writing careers than anything I can think of. So once you get started, once you get something going, you'll find, I think, that the revising part, for me anyway, is the fun part. It's that first, getting out that first sort of crappy draft or whatever it is, that is the hard part. And once you get that done, the rest is relatively easy. And so just author something.
I used to say I was a non-practicing writer. I'm like, why do lawyers get to say that? Right? Like, sometimes things get in the way. Anyway, Tommy, thank you so much for coming on. This was amazing. Thank you. Congratulations. The Elephant in the Room, 5 years strong, Dogland, just coming out. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. If you love it, please leave a review and follow us on social at Zibby Owens and at Zibby Readers.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.